that's a good way to start the program. That's Ranger, composer, and band leader Oliver Nelson on saxophone leading off on his own composition, Train Whistle. Train is spelled T-R-A-N-E, as in John Coltrane. It's from his 1960 album, Taking Care of Business, and also featuring George Tucker on bass, Roy Haynes, one of my favorite drummers on, of course, drums, Johnny Smith on organ, and Lem Winchester on vibraphone. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we continue our discussion from yesterday, in which we were taking a look at the transition from the Barack Obama administration to that of Donald Trump, this taking place with great anticipation on January the 20th, Friday. As Obama signs out and Trump signs in with his promised changes, are we signing up for battle with the new order? That's the issue that we began discussing yesterday. As you know, the confirmation hearings continue, and they will go beyond Friday into next week. And there's a great deal of pushback going on in Congress right now as Trump's nominees are being faced with extra scrutiny by the congressional panels asking them questions about what they intend to do, how they view their respective areas of assignment, what they intend to do in a way of getting at what the Trump administration will be doing. And it's quite interesting. But for reasons that you will discuss, what we must look at is, you know, it's good to know what these people stand for. But in any event, we have to be sensible here. Whatever they personally stand for actually doesn't matter. It's, to me, it's just a way of the committee flexing its muscles and saying, well, you know, we're putting up something of a fight. Because in the end, whatever they say before these committees about their personal feelings doesn't reflect what they are there to do. They will be getting instructions from the president as to what he wants done. And as it is at that time we will find out what they're made of, what they really are thinking. Are they the kind of principled people who would say, listen, this really goes against my grain here, and I quit? It's very unlikely they'll do that. So I don't understand why people are making such a big deal about their personal views on things. Has really very little to do with what inevitably they would be asked to do as a cabinet level member or senior member of Trump's White House staff. Your personal views have nothing to do with what the edicts will be. You will see to it that we get this done, get that done, get the next thing done. And it is at that point we will find out how committed they are to whatever it is they said before these committees, considering their confirmation, whether they were committed to it or not, whether they were principled when they said it or not. So I don't place very much faith in this idea that when you ask people, well, what do you personally believe? I don't understand it as being helpful in getting us to the point of learning where they will cut bait. You know, if it came to a point where they get orders from the president that certain things need to be done, how would we know whether they are complying, not just personally, but they're complying with the president's orders, or have the guts to even do that? So we see that as a continuing saga. It's going to go beyond the inauguration day on Friday. And we have several different departments still being filled, and the nomination process continues. The hearings will continue throughout that point. We have our president giving a little parting shot in the way of commutations and pardons, and so far the most controversial one was just yesterday with the pardoning of, it wasn't a pardon, it was a commutation. They're two different things. Commutation means that your sentence, the sentence that a person is serving, is shortened. You get a reprieve, and it's up to the president to decide, you know, what that would be. And a pardon is just the slate is wiped clean. So they're two different things. But this commutation of the sentence of Chelsea Manning is causing a great deal of backlash in Congress, and certainly in the intelligence community, who think that this is the worst thing that President Obama could have done. But it's an interesting fallout yet to come, because Chelsea Manning had as an advocate, a major advocate, Julian Assange, who had even said to the president, if you commute the sentence, I will even consider extradition, just because it is so important. Chelsea Manning has had tried to commit suicide twice, and there's a consideration there in the community of people who have leaked information for her life. And both Julian Assange and Edward Snowden had petitioned Barack Obama to consider commuting her sentence, and that is exactly what he did. Now, he has up until Friday to decide whether more commutations are coming or whether he would also issue additional pardons, and people are watching for that. I know in the African-American community of great interest, apart from political prisoners across the board, of great interest is a pardoning or exoneration of Marcus Garvey, who had organized the largest movement of African Americans in history, and whose movement was torpedoed by the intelligence community infiltrating and coming up with very bogus charges against him. And so he was deported back to Jamaica, and he died as a result of the government's actions to just simply smash the movement, the political movement. It was also social. It was clearly economic. And it was amassing, it had amassed the largest number of people associated with a black-led, a black-directed movement in the world. So there's a lot of interest there to see whether Barack Obama would actually do something at that level that would certainly redeem him in the eyes of many in the African-American community. All right, so let's take your calls at 888-874-4888. Let's begin this conversation anew. And we'll do that until, you know, this inauguration occurs, and then we'll move on from there, because we're looking really to find out what your disposition is at this time. We have been talking about the idea of coming to a point of reckoning with the political system, but more importantly, coming to a point of clarity about your own political situation and how you are fixed to deal with what's coming. In what ways have you begun to reorganize that? In what ways have you begun to prepare for what's coming? 888-874-4888. Well, we start out in Chicago. Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Trees, how's it going?
I'm hanging in. How about you?
Same here, hanging in. Greetings, Saul, to you and the rest of the PRN audience as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. In regards to the topic at hand, it's a little disturbing to me of the reaction that I'm getting, in particular with the Black community. You got one, you know, you got a significant group of people who are just panicking to no end, like the world is going to end. And then you have, you know, another group of people who, you know, are not Barack Obama fans. And I'd say that to say that they're basically kind of celebrating that, you know, he's leaving. Now, I'm no fan of Barack Obama, but, you know, the thing, too, is that this is no time to celebrate and it's no time to panic, because the thing is that there's work that needs to be done. And I'm not sure why people are just getting this message now. You know, it's like we should have been planning this 2 years ago when we figured out who was going to be the president, you know, who was going to likely win, you know, the presidency. Because when we saw the number of candidates that were presented to us, about 2 years ago, that should have been a warning right there to prepare for this day. So I'm kind of puzzled on, like I said, the extreme reactions that I'm getting towards this, because it's like I said, you know, there's work that needs to be done. And we have to go into it, you know, like that. You know, it's like we have work to do. So it's no time to celebrate and there's no time to panic, you know. So I just don't get the reactions that I'm hearing from, you know, from both sides of the coin.
Well, I would want to challenge you on that. I think you do have an idea of why you're getting this reaction. You know, it's been 8 years, and that's a long time for people to accumulate a lot of frustration and disappointment, especially those who had inordinately high hopes for what should have happened in their minds with an African-American president. Great. But it didn't happen. And the statistics are showing that people are, in the last 8 years, we see reports that basically speak to your point. Some reports are saying that Obama is leaving on a very high note, a favorability rating of 60% and perhaps even higher. He is looked, now there's reason, because look what they're comparing him to, that he has a great record, and, you know, he's being given a very nice send-off. But that may be true for a sector of America, but it's not true for all of America. The people who historically have been on the lower rungs of the economic ladder still remain on the lower rungs of the economic ladder. But they've had 8 years of this. And it was hoped, at least the way things were shaping up, and many of them thought that Hillary Clinton would have been elected and not Donald Trump. And so they figured, well, at least it's another Democrat. We know that beast, that Democratic Party. And maybe, you know, it would work out that another Democrat will come in and take up from where Obama leaves off. But it didn't work out that way. So no. You're getting a lot of people now coming to terms with the fact that, you know, reality is hitting. And where do they go for relief? What do they do? And I think you're right. There is also a sense of panic for people who believe that, you know, it's going to get so bad that they possibly may never rebound. That is a function of the media coverage and the campaign. Part of what Trump's campaign did, I think, is absolutely that, to instill fear.
Hillary's campaign did that as well.
Fear was a big factor here, and it worked to get the white male support overwhelmingly that he got, because they read him right. When you come down, you know, with a heavy hand, or at least you talk that kind of talk, you appeal to people who, on the flip side of the coin, had been nurturing a feeling of intense resentment because they felt that they had been losing ground, and entitlements, the feeling of entitlement in America, race-based America. So it worked very, very well to get him a lot of support, but still it instilled fear. And on one side, the fear was a welcome sign, you know, instilling fear was a welcome sign, because finally somebody is going to put all these black people and Latinos and poor people in their place. And then the fear on the flip side of the coin is, oh my God, you know, we up against a really bad situation here. What do we do?
Yeah. And this is the thing too, because we're reactionary people, and I just don't understand how we react to this when it happens, where, like I said, we should have been planning this 2 years ago. And so now it's going to come to a point where, okay, so Donald Trump's going to be the president. And like you said, what are we going to do now? What is our plan within the next, you know, 2 years or so? You know, are we going to be in the same position? You know, when the next election comes around, are we going to be, you know, panicking again? Because, you know, I'm pretty sure if we don't do something right now, Donald Trump or somebody worse is going to be elected the next president.
Well, I think, you know, that pattern is not going to change in the immediate future. It seems as if the pattern suggests that people have to literally be slammed up against the wall to have reality hit them really hard for them to really get to the business of doing what they're supposed to do, which is, again, organizing your community and organizing yourself. There are communities, with all of this going on, there are communities across the United States that don't have a single bit of interest in what is going on. They're not involved. They don't want it. And the reason is their communities are organized to meet just about all of their needs. So they don't have a relationship, a historic relationship with the electoral system. They don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
I refer a lot to the Mennonites or the folks out in Pennsylvania, the Amish.
Mm-hmm.
They don't participate in elections in the electoral process at all. They have no use for it. But their major needs are met. There's no homelessness. They build their own homes. They grow their own food. They even have their own water. They don't use your electricity. They don't have cell phones. You know, they have constructed their lives in such a way that they are self-governing. And there really isn't very much need for relationships with the outside world. They've gotten it together. We have to come to a point with the same philosophy to reduce our relationship with government, because government it is hopelessly exploited, and it is not going to change anytime soon. And our role, I think, is not necessarily to place so much emphasis on trying to change government. That's a system that's that's well entrenched and well scientifically organized. The best solution, I think, would be to try as best we can to organize our communities and organize ourselves.
And I agree with you, but like I said, stuff like that doesn't happen within a day or a week.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And this is, you know, this is par for the course in all societies where you have a majority of people who are really oppressed and locked out of a system. They spend a lot of time and experience a great deal of futility trying to humanize a system, to recognize, you know, their humanity and to respond to them in that way. But then we see that there are times when something cataclysmic occurs. Take India, for example. Whoever would have thought, you know, a skinny guy with practically no worldly goods would be the one to overthrow the big British Empire? But
yeah,
that's how it works sometimes. You need something that triggers that kind of reaction where people suddenly wake up and they see for themselves where they are with respect to a system that is designed to exploit them and ignore them. I don't know what it would take in the United States, perhaps a return to the old days where we just talked, we just heard Martin Luther King on Monday delineate a very excellent plan that was working. And if you listen to the speech, you see, my God, this small group did a heck of a lot and changed a lot, but also it fell victim to, you know, a lackadaisical attitude and people getting to a certain comfort level with the way things are. And so things fell apart. But it is possible that this transition will trigger in just about everybody a sense of responsibility for your own political, for the political outcomes that you want. Thanks for getting us started today.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. From Westchester, Nasheed, you're on the air.
Hello, Latrice. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. The pardoning, Leonard Peltier, Jamil Alamin, I hear nobody talking about these people.
Yes, he pardoned them. I'm not sure. I didn't double check this, whether it was a pardon or commutation.
For who?
He did pardon some political prisoners. And this is why we're waiting to see till Friday whether it will be far more than what it is he had contemplated doing.
Right. Okay. I mean, those people are the real heroes. I mean, they're the real people. I mean, the stuff that they suffered. I mean, the things that they was doing to Lynn Stewart and these other people, not giving them the medicine they need, and all that. This is insane. There is no going back to anything. If we go back to anything, we're going right back to lynching us on the street like they're shooting us right now. I mean, we got to come and think of we have to come to a higher moral situation than we are as African Americans and so-called Latinos. All those words, those names they call these people, man, they're all people of color. And the people who came here, Christopher Calamity and all of them, they didn't care about those people one bit. And so we got to get our minds straight to know that they don't care.
Well, I come back to the same assumption from the beginning. That's the work we have to do. That's not the work that the president has to do. It's the work that we have to force the president to do.
I think you just mentioned the Amish.
Yes.
I think we have to, as a minority of people of color, we got to do the same thing.
We have those models existing in Geechee country, South Carolina and North Carolina. These are self-sustaining communities. They still largely are. They still have a very strong community life. And we had it far more prevalently, but people just decided that, you know, they'll leave it to the government to make these critical decisions. And they shouldn't. It was one of the most devastating things to happen to the African-American community, I think, to allow themselves to be decimated under the guise that progress, you know, required you to move from the South. Well, of course, that was a practical matter. It was survival. It was all about survival. But there is, it's not as big as it ought to be, but there is a movement, people moving back to the South and readopting these modes of life where the community is a central theme, not individualism, but community life, which is the way African Americans have always lived. Community life, even in the cities, community life. But of course, the cities themselves have been dismantled. Poor housing, lack of jobs, and so forth. So the quality of community life deteriorated. We have to go back to the initial way of life, which was of great benefit to us.
You know, like the program this year with Progressive Radio. A lot of African Americans don't know nothing about it, whether it's north, south, east, or west. They're not into digging in. The book "Vanishing Right to Live." What the man said in that book was that we're insignificant innocent. So you got to go. They don't. They really. I mean, we got to look at it at the real deal. Because I mean, you know, this thing is ridiculous. I mean, you can't walk up to an African American and have a so called Latino and have a good conversation about or a direction to go, then we're not going anywhere. They're going to be dealing with materialism. That's what's going on in here. Everybody's trying to race each other. They have a Benz, Audi, and all that kind of nonsense. But they're not. The kids are walking down the street with these cell phones, walking into cars. I mean, there's no consciousness of who they are, where they are, or you know, where they come from. You know, we all been, you know, some people can go back to 1820 in their ancestry in America. So, but how many people really care about that, or even go that way? I mean, so our brothers come from Africa and other places. Some of them come over here and they get caught up in this nonsense. And the people who have moved back to the South, they can't even leave their lawnmower. This is in Tuskegee. The brother couldn't even leave his lawnmower on his own, what's in it, because of the drugs and all the other things. So we got to look at this thing a big round, you know, big way, because it's not just, you know, these guys are sitting down here worried about what football player this and they got guys on. I don't know what the kind of money they're making, but what are you talking about? You're not talking about, you're talking about a football game and not anything about a strategy to survive in this society. That's all I have to say. And you have a great day.
Thank you for contributing today. Mike from New York, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, we have some really big problems here. Are you speaking on a speakerphone or something? Because you're sounding garbled.
Okay, hold on a second. Okay, is it better?
Yes, a little bit better, yes. Mike, are you there? Okay, we might have lost Mike. So he can call back. Call back at 888-874-4888. This is the kind of discussion that we should be having. Hopefully, you know, it would get better with time that we don't have these conversations just as the hammer is about to fall. But, you know, you have to live with what it is reality is. We have to live with that and make the best of the situation, but begin the process of thinking ahead. It's not, I agree with Henry from Chicago, it's not going to happen overnight, but it should begin to happen, and it should begin to happen with a greater volume. We don't have enough of a mass. And when we do have masses of people coming together, it is, it seems, spontaneous. And to address a specific issue or policy, and then it dies until the next major calamity occurs. But that is not the case across the board. The people who are most oppressed are the ones who really need to get it together. Everybody needs to get it together. But the people who are most oppressed, the people who are struggling every single day just to keep it together, we have to find a way to cultivate a sense of what is the plan for you? How are we going to get through this together? And that is really the nitty-gritty of politics. It translates to individual action, individual thinking, and how are you going to fashion a system that works? It's not going to be perfect at all. It's not going to be perfect. And it certainly won't be immediate, but it is important to begin to fashion something. And, it, you know, when we look back at the historical record, we see how communities thrived, poor communities thriving right there in Brooklyn, in Crown Heights, for example, which used to be called Crow Heights because blacks lived there. But they were the first free community in New York State. And they required nothing from the outside world. They grew their own food. They built their own homes. They had their own employment. And they, you know, they engaged in commerce with other folks who needed their services. But there was no great big thirst to abandon their way of life and, you know, get into the big city life of that time. It was a system that worked. Totally self-sufficient, self-governing. And somewhere in there is great wisdom. Somewhere in there is a prototype that can be used to rebuild, to reconstitute ourselves. Even though, of course, we don't have the financial resources in many cases to do a lot of things that need to be done. But that is not the only thing that matters. What matters is rebuilding and reconstituting our communities, our sense of identity, all across the spectrum. We need these kinds of actions. We need those communities where everybody is living to develop a sense of humanity, to develop a sense of consciousness about what's the right way to live. Irrespective of the government, you become your own government in key aspects that you control. Governments are not designed to see to your interests. I mean, it's just not the way it is. Governments are designed to protect the interests of the elite of society. The rest of the folks are a necessary evil to deal with as far as they're concerned. But the purpose of government has nothing to do with building your community and giving you a sense of assurance, a sense of safety and all of that. That's what we expect. But that's not the role of government, not the way government sees itself. They've got other things to do, including and especially seeing to the interests of the power elite. So we've been functioning with a wrong definition of political power for a long time. And we readily yield our power and our own right to self-governance. And we've been doing that more and more and more. The more we do that, the less control we have over our communities and the less control we have over the decisions and policies that the government makes, because we yield that power to them. Right now, the big concentration is in the nomination process and the confirmation process. And we look at, for example, the area of education, which is a huge issue in our communities, except that they're already making it clear that there are other things to do. We don't have time to decide whether you should have a public school. We're just going to take a look at your statistics and see whether your students are performing according to our standards if they're not, we shut down the school. Very simple. That's the government's approach. But we don't have alternatives. And if we do have alternatives, we don't have enough backing. We don't have enough people surrounding these ideas, giving them life and protecting this turf called education. We don't have it. So then they do whatever they want to do. And what is coming in the area of education, and we've been talking about this for quite a while, quite a few years now, is just shut down all of the public schools and privatize education so that your children become a profit center. It has nothing to do with the quality of education or the utility of the education they will get. They just will be leased out, really, to private companies, and they will be a profit center. Well, you can see the logic of that if you understand that we are definitively now in the world of the oligarchs. These people, the only thing they understand is money and making more money and reinforcing all of these principles and ways of thinking that allow us to justify making some really stupid decisions in the service of making more money. That's what's going to happen. It's happening now. New Orleans doesn't have a public school. It's gone. Detroit is practically emptied of its schools. Chicago, record number of school closings. New York City has been, you know, set up fully for the invasion of charter schools. And it's being touted by liberals and progressives, like the mayor of the city of New York and the governor of the state of New York. They see nothing wrong with this. So we have to get to the nut of the issue, which is we're not organized at all. We're not an organized community across the board. We're not organized. And even when circumstances suggest strongly that we ought to fight, we first have to take the time to organize, which means you're not engaged in a fight, you're engaged in the basics first, you know? And that would take quite a few years. So this is where we are, and we have to talk about this. We're not prepared. We're not prepared for a fight. We don't have, when I say, I don't mean that we don't have anything, but we do not have the power that we need that comes from organization. We don't have that working for us right now, working in our favor right now. And the more desperate the conditions are in our communities, the more we see the need for organization. We've got to get ourselves together. Whether we are together or not, the system has its plans. It's clear about what it's going to do. We have very few plans, if any plans at all. And we are constantly in reactive mode, and that is itself a huge, that's a, the most important, I would say the most important deficit that we have. We have very little to fight back with, although, and this is the irony, we are very powerful. We have a great deal of power. So at the same time that we're super exploited, at the same time that we're super oppressed, we also have this dormant power that we refuse to breathe life into because it is a great form of protection for all of us. But we allow all the little tricks, we allow them to work by inattention and by giving up the work that we're supposed to be doing to promote this kind of cohesion in our community. It's the only way we're going to survive. It's the only way we are going to survive. So we have to put up a fight. That's what's on the horizon right now. As of Friday, Trump takes office. By 10 minutes after the ceremony, he's hard at work. He's going gangbusters. Ralph from Maryland, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Sharice.
Good afternoon to you.
Thank you for your time. Very happy to be speaking with you this year. After last year and you're in good health and moving forward, I thoroughly enjoyed that whole Martin Luther King.
You know what, Ralph, I'm sorry to disturb you, but are you speaking on a speakerphone or something? It's getting a little fuzzy.
No, it isn't. I mean, I'm not. And I noticed even in listening to Gary's show before you, there's been some, like, I don't know, maybe there's an interference going on both ends. Is it a little clearer now?
Well, we'll proceed. It does sound a little bit garbled, but I think we'll hang in here with you. Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, I think what you're saying today is a conclusion of a lot of deconstruction that was done last year that you did on different shows and that the audience, fellow members called in. And what we've come down to is a conclusion that the most effective thing we can do at this point is organize.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once we conclude that that is the next step, as we continue to conclude, I believe that whole series of conclusions will yield an evident plan. And I've been thinking on this myself, and I think when I listen to all that we talked about last year and all that's going on now, I try to find the common denominator in the issue and see if that could be what the problem is, because a lot of times the solution is in the problem. And I think right now we're suffering from a corrupt and purchased news media. And if we could, if money were not an issue and our imaginations were not restrained from known reality, the quickest solution would be, oh, well, let's just, do a media takeover and let's start from there. And we'd have somewhere to coordinate. Because if what Brother King was saying concerning the whole breadbasket movement, that
yes.
was extremely effective. I mean, that's effective. And I think where he is alive today, one of his focuses would be in the news media, or at least to the point of being able to bring us all together under one umbrella, on one platform that we could, so that we could not only speak power, but we could speak collectively, so that we'd be more effective in speaking. And that really comes down to if that's true, you know, sequentially, logically, if that's true, if that is the major problem as far as us being able to organize, the lack of the news media and true journalism on a collective level, because there's a lot of grassroots things going on and there's a lot of good things being done, but until it's being broadcast and reported, there'll be no momentum, or at least the momentum will be hindered greatly. So as I'm listening and I've been working on personally, I think the solution to our next step is to organize. And as I'm agreeing with you totally, I think organization, once we conclude and say, okay, we have to organize, that's what we're doing, that's what we're doing, then it becomes a matter of not what, because we know what, organize, it becomes an issue of how. And the how part of it is where I've been giving it a lot of thought, and I think that it means we do need one platform. And without going into a whole lot of detail, you just imagine that if Chris Hedges, if yourself, if Gary, if Truth Dig, if a lot of the effective and integrity operating presenters of information and news were to be aligned, then that would help us greatly. And
I continue to say, we have more than enough models to go from. We have more mm-hmm. than enough models available mm-hmm. to us, including, you know, a part of the movement. You take a look at, for example, the Nation of Islam has the largest circulated paper serving the African-American community.
Okay.
Marcus Garvey was a publisher. And all of these movements, the Black Press was founded by a minister.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we have models that have been extremely effective, highly successful. You mentioned Operation Breadbasket. It, as you said correctly, from the speech that we heard on Monday, all those things that Martin Luther King enumerated as successes of Operation Breadbasket. Now, who was the next generation leading Operation Breadbasket? Do you know?
No, ma'am.
Well, it was Jesse Jackson.
Mm.
Need I say more?
Mm.
Here you had the church. It all started in the church. The speech really was the 10th anniversary of the founding of this movement from and within the church. It had an economic component that was very successful. It had a cultural component. It had a political component. It had a community development component. And he enumerated all the things that they had gotten done with a very small staff. Very small group of people. And then it shifted to the next generation after Martin Luther King's assassination. The next generation that came in had a different way of thinking about community development, and that was Jesse Jackson. Where is the Operation Breadbasket now? So this is what I'm saying. It's not that we lack models. We have them. There are more than enough models, all different kinds of models. I was relating not too long ago on the program that I found this map of Harlem during the time of Marcus Garvey's movement. And I looked at it, but initially I didn't look at it closely enough, but what caught my attention was all these areas that were shaded in. And I wondered, well, what is this about? It was a map of Harlem with several areas, many areas of blocks shaded in. And those were the UNIA-affiliated businesses owned and operated by UNIA members back in the 1920s. And it was significant. You can go to a dry cleaner. You can go to a printer. You had grocery stores. You had butcher shops. You had hairdressing parlors, as they called them. You had all kinds of professional businesses. And that was what those shaded areas represented, where those businesses were located in Harlem. It was an amazing thing. But there is no shadow of a likeness to that existing in Harlem today, because the people who came after these pioneers fell down on the job. They didn't think it was necessary. It was hard work. It was hard work. They're not interested in the nutty business of, you know, grimy business of door-to-door pounding on the door, finding out how's everything going with you and so forth. They're not interested in that. They want to be noted at conferences and you know, hobnob with people and that kind of stuff. They're not paying attention to the work. Operation Breadbasket died with Jesse Jackson, who, instead of continuing the work, decided it was far more profitable for him to just be a poser and use the name of Operation Breadbasket to cover what his true intention was. It's like the Rainbow Coalition. When was the last time you attended or heard of a meeting of the Rainbow Coalition?
Well, that whole thing is a tragedy where he came in and basically sold out for self purposes, for various reasons. But that's what we do, is we pick up that model, having seen that open area for error, having seen that weak spot, and fix it. And that's in the structuring. That's in talking to MBA and saying, look, how do we get this going? Are we going to structure this in a certain way? And in my mind, as I'm talking about an alignment, as I do agree, we do have these models. The issue is weaving these things together. We need to come together. We have a that they not have. We have,
but we have to go beyond saying it. We have to do it. And we don't have to wait. Because if you wait on people to get the message and then to act on it, you would never get anything done. You have to start it yourself.
I totally agree. And I'm on it. I'm just saying that what I'm saying at this point is that we need to go forward in conversation, have them conclude that organization is the next step, is the key, is the answer, and everything within the context of that, and we'll move forward instead of making lateral conversations that, okay, over here they're doing this. Okay, it's relevant if it doesn't lead to some organization. And as far as that goes, there's a I purchased the new majormedia.com, and I would love it to be, and I'm working for it to be a platform on which we can all power the major media every time we refer to it as the major media. It's a misnomer. That's not, a lot of people are getting, most people out of an older age bracket are getting their information from alternative news sources. But as long as we collectively power them by continuing to refer to them, it just helps to empower them. We need to empower something else. We need to empower the takeover, the new model, the new major media, to say, okay, this is a network, you know what I'm saying, that is structured nonprofit, that consists of a panel of various people I just mentioned, a lot of affiliated with PRN that you've had interviewed, Brother Cornell West, people that Gary's had on, to oversee. These are people who we know have good motives and would be good to have in place and effective to have in place and have enough of following and understanding and experience to oversee and a good heart enough to continue to oversee this movement.
Well, I agree with you, but I caution that we're almost out of time. And by that I mean we have suffered, Dr. Leonard Jeffries would say, we suffer so much from the paralysis of analysis, we don't get anything done. We need somebody to just get it done. Get something going. In whatever sphere of influence you happen to operate, just start something, get it going. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be going.
So a lot of times those things get bought or people get hurt that are involved. It's going to take, and I understand and I believe what you're saying. I'm saying simultaneously as I've been doing this, I look at different things that come up, and there's a lot of stuff I don't want to share on the internet. There's a lot of I don't want to be approached. You understand? I'm not saying fear is going to
it doesn't take much. We heard right here on this program, we heard David from Brooklyn talk about making sure the sidewalks are even on every block. That's possible. And that's, it's a small thing, but it's a big thing. And it expresses concern about the aesthetics of the block and the safety of people on the block. And that's an incredible thing to start. Well, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you so much for listening. We'll join each other again tomorrow and continue the conversation in this critical era of the transition. Pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.